The pride, passion, and pageantry of college football lives here. This is the Paul Feinbaum Show, Hour 2 Podcast.
And we welcome you back. The second hour of the program. We haven't made it to the second half yet. I'm just thinking of college basketball, where they are currently in the second half between Tennessee and Florida. Matt Baker is joining us from the Tampa Bay paper, and always good to catch up. He covers the Gators. Matt, good afternoon. And I realize we're watching it on the fly here. What's your take on the Gators as they try to hang with Tennessee right now?
Well, I'm like you. I'm football just about all the time, so I've been writing football stuff today.
Well, it's because I'm not sure how much how good of an investment in March the Gators are going to be in basketball. Let's talk about where you what you have been doing, and what is the schedule right now for Dan Mullen and the Gators in terms of spring practice.
Yeah, they're scheduled to end spring practice end of next week. So, you know, they've been going for a couple weeks now. They started a little bit earlier than usual, and the thought process was this is a lot of young team, pretty young team. They've got the time to do it, so why not kind of start early and give all these people who don't have a ton of experience or are learning new positions, that sort of thing, give them more time, you know, in end of March onward to review that film, just because everything is new. I mean, you got to remember, again, young team, and the fact that there wasn't a spring last year. This is the first spring for a lot of those guys. So this is more reps and more time for them to kind of break that down in the off season by starting early.
Matt, you know what the narrative is and will continue to be as we get as we move through spring into summer into SEC media days in the season. It's all about the dogs. And I realized last year it was all about the dogs, but it just seems like this year it's a little more legitimate. How is that playing in Gainesville?
Yeah, I'm sure they're not going to be thrilled about it because Florida and Georgia played last year and the Dogs were not triumphant in that one. Florida kind of, you know, Dan Mullen finally got over the Georgia hump, let's put it that way. That finally happened for him and the Gators. But I think that's a fair assessment as I read things and I look at this Gators team in 2021. I think their offense is going to take a step back. You typically don't have a historic offense the way they did last year and get better when you lose a Kyle Pitt and a Kyle Trask, one of the better quarterbacks they've ever had. It doesn't happen. So I think it's fair to expect a step back, not necessarily a huge step, but a step back offensively. Defensively, I think it's fair to assume that they're going to progress to the mean after how bad, you know, just historically bad they were last year by Gator standards. But I don't know that the defense is going to make as much of a step forward to make up for everything and to get them in SEC championship contention. So Florida people won't like me saying it, but yeah, I absolutely do think Georgia is the team to beat in the East, and they're going to be right in the playoff mix next year.
Let's talk about the key positions on this Gator team, starting at quarterback. What what is the level of confidence there, and what do you expect to happen?
Yeah, Emory Jones is going to be the guy, barring something crazy or an injury or something like that. The Gators aren't going to come out and say it because that's not how Dan Mullen operates. He wants competition for as long as he can get it. But look, Emory Jones is going to be the guy. He's waited his turn. He was the handpicked guy, Mullen's first quarterback in his first recruiting class here at Florida. He gave Emory Jones his first scholarship offer back when he was at Mississippi State, and Emory had just finished his freshman season. He is the guy. He kind of fits the way that Mullen wants to run an offense. With it, not just a willing quarterback in terms of running, but a willing and able running quarterback. And that's who Emory is. I don't have a good enough feel yet for what I think are reasonable expectations for him. Obviously, we've seen him over the last couple years. We've seen him make some good throws, seen him make some good runs. But I don't have a sample size yet to have a good read on, is he another Nick Fitzgerald? Is he a bust? I don't have a great read on that yet. But it's going to be his show. I'm almost positive.
Matt, we Gator fans wanted Dan Mullen to open it up and start scoring, and he did. But would you not agree that Jones is a little more of the Dan Mullen prototype than what we've seen with Franks and ultimately with Kyle Trask?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because, again, look, Florida had a commit in the 2018 class when Mullen got there. Matt Corral, who's obviously at Ole Miss now and one of the better returning quarterbacks, I think, in the country next year. But Emory was a better fit. Emory can move very well. You think about the quarterbacks that Mullen has had success with, they're better runners than Kyle Trask was. You know, give Mullen a lot of credit for getting the most out of Kyle Trask because he had to kind of switch his offense so he wasn't doing the square peg round hole kind of thing. But Emory moves very well. Stuart Reese, the offensive lineman who played at Mississippi State for Mullen, now with the Gators, compared him to Nick Fitzgerald at Mississippi State, and I think that's probably a good comparison. So again, we've seen flashes. I know he has big play running potential. I know he has a very strong arm because we've seen that. The question is, can he do it consistently? Can he be the kind of leader and the alpha in the locker room, that sort of thing? And I don't have answers to that yet. I'm not saying he can't do it. I'm just saying, ask me in September.
I will. I will definitely ask you in September. Matt,
good.
We have had a couple of conversations about the rather bizarre middle to end of last year with Dan Mullen. And I'm not beating a dead horse here, but it is now mid-March, spring ball about to begin. Do you think all of that, and there are too many to mention, too many bizarre episodes to mention, has that evaporated with the winter breeze, or do you think some people are still going to wonder a little bit about Dan Mullen in spite of everything that you said, especially beating the Dogs last November?
Yeah, I think there is going to be, I don't want to say a schism or anything like that. I think that's too extreme. But what happened at the end of last year especially, that doesn't go away. You know, obviously the losing streak at the end and the debacle against Oklahoma, the LSU loss, how bad that was, the brawl against Missouri. Here I am rehashing everything after you said we didn't want to rehash everything. But all those things add up to something. And there are certainly going to be some people around Gainesville who remember that. And that will come up again, depending on what happens with Mullen in the NFL down the line, depending on what happens with this year, depending on if there's any other off-the-field stuff or just bizarre headline. Those things happen, and they're not going to go away. Now, if the Gators go 11-1 next year and beat Georgia and are in the playoff mix, then that's something that kind of gets pushed aside. But I think as we look at Dan Mullen and his long-term future, those are things that happen, and people are going to have a long memory of that.
Matt, it seemed like for a couple of years we've had criticism, at least here, you probably heard it as well, of Tom Grantham. He's still there, as last I heard. Is the defense going to be any better?
It is, and I don't mean to be cute when I say this, but it probably cannot get a whole lot worse. Again, it was historically bad last season. I'm going to read through some awful stats. You ready?
Please.
The scoring defense was the program's worst since 1917. That was before the last pandemic, by the way. The run defense was the worst since 1971 for the program. The pass defense gave up 9 more passing touchdowns than any Gators year since at least World War II. The third down defense was the program's worst since at least 2009, and they were 98th in the country on fourth down. There were some sacks. It wasn't completely awful, but it was not very good at all. So I do think they are going to take a step forward because just law of averages, they're going to have to. Then when you start kind of drilling in a little bit, one of the problems they had was they didn't, the interior of the defensive line wasn't good enough, especially the first couple games when Kyrie Campbell was out. Brought in a couple grad transfers, Antonio Shelton, Daquan Newkirk from Penn State and Auburn. I think they're going to kind of shore up that and maybe let Zach Carter move a little bit more from inside onto the outside, that sort of thing. Some changes in the secondary and coaching and personnel as well. So I think they're going to get better. I'm not going to say they're going to be a great defense. I don't know about that. But I do think they're going to take a step forward this year for sure.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. So we'll quit talking about Todd Grantham. It's just not fair.
Yeah, that's kind of the way things go in this profession. The defensive coordinator is struggling. Nobody likes him. That's just the way it is. And he's been a hot button lightning rod in the league for quite some time. I guess there are some Georgia fans who are still unhappy with him, I'm guessing. Is that right?
Yeah. And I remember, two or three years ago, there was some concern that he might be leaving to go somewhere else. And I remember reading a statement.
To go to the Bengals.
Right.
That's exactly right. The Bengals wanted him after his first year. And that's another reason why I think things are going to get better. I view last year, and again, it was very, very bad for the Florida defense. I think it was more of a blip and kind of a fluke from a bunch of weird circumstances than a sign of where they're going. You know, the Gators defense hasn't been, you know, the way it was with Muschamp, but it hasn't been bad the previous 2 years. So I think that was just a weird confluence of events with no spring ball and some opt-outs and injuries and youth and just a whole bunch of things that led to the debacle that we saw last year on defense.
Matt, it's always great to have you on. Thank you so much. We will talk very soon. And, of course, in September. I've already marked that one down.
Deal. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you, Matt Baker, joining us. Meanwhile, talking about the Gators football program, the Gators basketball program is in trouble in Nashville, down by 13 with about 8 minutes and change. We are going to take a break, and just when you think that things have settled down at the University of Tennessee from a football standpoint.
You are listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
Apparently some more bad news. We will share that with you when we come back. Rittenberg reporting at this hour that three Tennessee players, second-year linebacker Martavius French and incoming recruits Aaron Willis and Isaac Washington have been arrested on drug charges in connection with a campus residence hall incident, according to the university police log. Two others also arrested. No confirmation from that. Obviously, Tennessee pretty busy right now playing Florida in the SEC tournament, but that is a rather negative story out of Knoxville for new coach Josh Heupel. We will update you on that if we have anything a little bit later on. Phone calls are welcome here at 855-242-7285. And let's check in now with John, who is in Kentucky. Hey, John.
Hey, is this Paul?
Yes, it is.
Hey, well, you know, I think the most hurtful thing for Wildcats was the not able to practice and to get the kids in spring, summer, and reload, having all those kids, you know, there's no way, you know. I don't know. Just, you know, by February, they would have been pretty good.
So, yeah, you know, John, everybody had the same problem.
That killed them. Well, I don't think any of those schools had as many coming in.
Well, that is fair, but that's always the risk you take. But thanks for sharing that. Appreciate it. Marie is calling next. Marie, thank you, and good afternoon.
Hey.
Hey there.
Hey, Paul. How are you?
Marie, I am doing well. Hope you are.
I am just great. I just want to tell you that I am probably athletically illiterate. I watch your show with my husband, and I am just amazed because you are one of the best interviewers I think I've ever heard. You handle everybody with grace and kindness, no matter how off the wall or whatever. And I just wanted to tell you, I appreciate you so much. Thank you, Paul.
Marie, thank you. And thanks you and your husband for supporting us. That means a great deal.
And we do. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You be well. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Cheerleader is up next.
I'm happy with that.
Hello.
Hey, cheerleader.
Hi there. I thought I'd give you a little break about basketball and the tournaments, but gosh, I think everybody in the world's watching it and loving it because I hadn't had any sports to watch. But I wanted to change the subject to love and marriage for just a minute, if you don't mind.
Shoot.
My husband and I have been married for 50 years today.
50 years.
And we don't know where it went because we don't look like it. And he says, you know, our marriage was made in heaven like thunder and lightning. I said, yeah, it was.
Well, I'm always curious, cheerleader, for somebody who has been married for any length of time, which, you know, a long marriage to me is like 3 years. But is there, I mean, obviously you get married very young, I'm assuming that, and because I've met you.
Yeah.
What would you say to those young people out there who are maybe struggling or about to get married? What would you say is the key?
Well, I would say that, first of all, you got to know the person you're going to marry. And knowing them for 6 months, that's not long enough.
Right.
A year really isn't long enough. Year and a half and two. Year and a half, questionable. 2 years, good. Mm. Now, the people may not wait that long, but you got to know your person. You got to marry somebody, not because you like the way he dances, the way he dresses, and he's a good-looking man and this and that.
Mm-hmm.
You got to marry him because you can get along with him. He's got a good sense of humor. He likes your sense of humor, la-di-da, la-di-da. And do not expect all love and passion and all that for 50 years.
Really?
You can expect the love, but, I mean, you know what I'm talking about, but I don't know if everybody can carry that on for that length of time. A lot of people, when that wears off, they kind of, you know, hasta la vista.
That's fairly disappointing. That's fairly disappointing to hear, cheerleader.
Well, no. And your children are so core if you're fortunate enough to have children.
Right.
Because they are the joy. Now, let me tell you one more thing.
Okay.
So many people ask my husband, how did you get her to marry you? You know, every man, all the guys ask, like probably somebody's asked you that 50 times or all these other men that call in and whatnot. How did you get her to marry you? And he said, well, you know, I married up. And after he got off the phone, I said, Tommy, I'm tired of you saying that. I said, that means I married down. And I don't want you to use that anymore. So it took me a couple of minutes, and then I thought of something. I said, you know what? If somebody asks you that again, why don't you just tell them that you think a little Jack Daniels had something to do with it?
Joyner, how long did you know Tommy before you married him?
I knew him at the University of Alabama for at least 2 years.
Okay.
And both of us had dated a lot of other people. I dated a lot of people in high school.
Right.
Early college. And then you just kind of fit and stick, you know. But it was 2 years. It was 2 years. And that's how it is. And, you know, it's not all.
Well, my final question on this love and marriage seminar here, which is available online as well. But what does he think of your foray into this program?
He does not like me calling.
Okay.
He does not like me calling. I do not know why. Everybody else does, and when I don't get in on the line for, you know, a long time, or I hadn't been able to call in, the friends say, well, has Paul dropped you? And I say, no, he hadn't. Sometimes I can't. I work. I'm a working woman. And but it's just, you know, Paul, you just help us all. You're just so good. And since this is a sports show, I do want to say what my prediction is, or the way I want it to be for the SEC tournament. I want it to be, and we'll know if Florida's beating Tennessee, so Alabama's going to play Florida?
No, I think you got that reversed.
Okay. Well, I want Alabama, of course, to be up there and either Florida or Arkansas.
Well, cheerleader, you're not going to see Florida since they are down right now 69-53 with about 4 minutes to go. So sorry about that. Let's continue. Let's get back to the real world here, not the marital world, and talk to Stetson, who is up next. Hello, Stetson. Stetson, you there? Don't hear Stetson. Let me try. Who we got? I'm just going to grab a caller here. Barry is up next. Hey, Barry.
Hey, Paul.
Hi there.
I was in high school when you got to Birmingham writing your article.
Thank you.
And it was a treat to sit down at the breakfast table in high school and read your articles.
Well, Barry, thank you. Those are some incredible memories in my life. I'm always always happy when somebody remembers.
Heard anything bad in Birmingham in the news business about Bear Bryant or Alabama. And then it wasn't a year before you were totally flipped around and couldn't say anything bad about them. But I've got two things I wanted to say. What's happened to the programming on the SEC channel today? How come we didn't get to see Alabama play basketball today?
Barry, let me explain. And probably should have done a better job of this. The Alabama game was on ESPN today, not the SEC channel.
Why did it say SEC Net?
Well, yeah, this is confusing, I will admit. In years past, and I think this changed about a year ago, the SEC Network had the first 2 days of the tournament, Wednesday and then Thursday and Friday. And I believe last year, or it could have been the year before, ESPN started doing the SEC afternoon games. And then the evening games came over to the SEC Network. So the Alabama game and the Florida-Tennessee game, which is going on right now, are on ESPN. And then the night games are going to be right here on the SEC.
Okay. Well, I had to sit through the South Carolina and
Yeah, Barry, I'm glad you called. Alabama tomorrow, though, will be on ESPN. Let me make that clear. I think I'm right, guys. So, and I, you're not the first person to complain about this, or at least point it out. So the games after tonight, the games are on ESPN right now. Tonight they're here on the SEC. And then tomorrow they go. Tomorrow the doubleheader is on ESPN, and then Sunday the single game for the championship is on ESPN. So I'm glad we pointed that out. I should have done a better job of that yesterday. But I apologize for you Alabama fans who missed the.
You were listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show
win over
podcast.
Mississippi State. We will take a break. More to come on the program, and we appreciate you sticking around. And we welcome you back. And, of course, Alabama wins today 85-48. What a victory that was, a 37-point win for the Crimson Tide. And right now it looks like Alabama will be meeting Tennessee. There's still a little bit of time left in the game, but Tennessee is up 71-59 with 3:05 to go. So looks like the Vols will take on Alabama in a 1-versus-4 matchup, 2 games tonight. It is March, and of course right now, as we talked to Mitch Barnhart the other day, the NCAA Men's Basketball Committee meeting, figuring out a rather difficult field, not only because of the seedings and people on the bubble, but with COVID issues popping up in various parts of the country. For many, many years, our next guest was tasked with being responsible for that. Former executive at the NCAA, Greg Sheehan. He also has been a consultant for the SEC and many others. Greg, it's great to have you on the show. Great to have you back. And I can only imagine what must go through your mind on this particular weekend in March. How are you?
I'm doing great. Great to talk to you, Paul. Yeah, one contingency after another. It just adds to the list and makes for interesting times.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the news of the last 2 days, and there has been a lot. I mean, first we had Duke, bowing out because of COVID issues, but the ones today are more problematic, I would think. The Virginia story, the Kansas story. You have Georgia Tech. I don't know exactly. I think there's a cutoff tomorrow night. You could help me on that. But what are the protocols right now? Because there are a lot of confused fans out there and confused players and coaches as well.
Well, you're exactly right. We're into the zone now where it really does matter, because if you look at the next few days, tomorrow teams start arriving in Indianapolis. So the AQs and the teams that are likely to be at larges will start making their way to Indianapolis to get settled in, because they all have to have at least 7 days of negative tests before they can be cleared, and they'll have to be in Indianapolis with 2 days of all negative tests before they can even do shootarounds and practice. And so, you know, we're inside that zone. The first four is 6 days away, and the first round is 7 days away. And essentially the protocol is that the quarantine, once any one of the tier one party is determined to have a true positive, which means, you know, they verify it multiple times, that everybody in tier one will need to quarantine for 10 to 14 days. So depending on the exact protocol that's followed. So we're inside that time now. So if you are a team that has a resume to get into the tournament, and you're just in the conference tournaments playing through, and you were to have an interaction with somebody and get one individual in the party to become infected, it really does take you out. And so it makes for a lot of complicated monitoring that will be going on this weekend, which the NCAA has been set up to do. They would be doing it, by the way, COVID or not, for other reasons as well, just in terms of injuries and player and coach availability. But it makes it an extraordinarily complicated puzzle for them to work through over the next several days.
Greg Shaheen with us, the former NCAA administrator. And Greg, let's talk a little bit about those many years that you were the point man on this committee. We had Mitch on the other night talking about, you know, what the chairman does, and that is an awesome responsibility. But how did it all work from your end?
Well, it's just you know, you recognize that there are thousands of people working, volunteering over the next few weeks to put this on, and so you're in a room with the 10 committee members and about 5 colleagues, and the whole world's watching. I think, with the exception of maybe Vatican City, where the one place where our work gets critiqued even more when our white puff of smoke comes out. And there's a lot of debate, a lot of passion. Very important to follow guidelines. Very important that once you walk in the room, that you put your hat out, you put your hat down. Mitch always, I know this year has been referring to, he takes his Kentucky hat off when he walks into the room, and that's it. You have to represent all of the Division I institutions to make smart decisions as you go. But you also have to anticipate every contingency that happens. And so, you know, for the most part, the committee is going about its business, but it's, you know, having, as it did last year, it's having to spend a reasonable portion of its time contemplating all the different wrinkles that can happen here that really are out of its control. But it's most important that they work on selecting the best 37 at-large teams this year to match up with the AQs for the field of 68. And then they have to let, destiny play through. And it will be very interesting to watch.
Greg, it's easy to be a pundit from my side of the fence and find fault. And I've done basketball shows on I've hosted the radio show for many, many years, and you're just inviting somebody to take a shot, and there's almost pressure to find some fault. I realize that's not the concern of the committee, but what is the most difficult thing to figure out and get right when you're in that room?
say in a normal year, it is most likely Saturday. As the day goes on, you really don't have to tell anybody on the committee. It just becomes very clear. The gravity becomes much greater. The arguments become even more extended because they've had the time for 4 days now to work through all the details. And you realize that in making votes as a group over the next several hours, where you really set the field on Saturday, that you're making decisions that will be debated all over the world. But you're also very much aware of the student athletes that are affected, all the followers that are affected, for better or worse, the awareness that it can affect people's livelihoods. And so there's just a lot of gravity to it. You want to make sure to get it right. You want to make sure that you have all the facts. And so, you know, I can remember many years when a student athlete would get hurt on a Friday night, and the team was a really borderline scenario, and one of their star players would be hurt, and in an uncertain way, not in like a Kenyon Martin way, but in a way where it just wasn't clear how significant the damage would be, and it's something that becomes very sensitive. You're mindful of it. You're aware of it, but you ultimately understand that that's what your job is, to be in that room and to make the best decisions you can. And they do it really, honestly. I've always admired it. It's tough work, and it's thankless, quite honestly. In a five-year term, you know, they'll spend about a year of it doing basketball work. And it's tough to get the critique, but it's also part of the tradition. The debate is what makes all of college athletics and all of athletics great.
Greg Shaheen with us, the former NCAA administrator who essentially was the point person for the men's basketball committee, among other things. Finally, and not to be too cynical here, and I agree with what you've said, and we're talking about serious issues here and student athletes. We're also talking about a $1 billion event that we found out last year. Without it, last year and this year, we probably wouldn't have an NCAA. How does that seep into the room, the gravity of the money?
I don't think anybody's, missing that point. I think that I think it all comes together. I mean, I think the, and honestly, you know, I'm probably one of the people that would say moments like this, I think, are healthy. Because it requires the kind of discussion and value debate about what we're doing. We have 90 championships and so forth, and this is a remarkable thing. But, the intercollegiate athletics is not perfectly aligned, for example, with Olympic sports. It doesn't prioritize it in the same way. And I'm not suggesting that we de-emphasize the football and basketball, so forth. But there are discussions in the middle there that I think wind up getting caught up in special interests and so forth. And every once in a while, it's not the worst thing in the world to have a reality check and for it to be under this circumstance in any way. But otherwise, I wonder, when would some of those discussions take place? When would some of those tough calls be made? And I wish for the overall enterprise that everybody takes the most of this time, still plenty of time left until we have whatever normal is going to be going forward, to really think about, are we doing the right things? Are our resources aligned the way they need to be? And is this really, does it really make sense to have this many sports or to have, this many teams in one division on a particular sport? I think there's just a lot of that could always take another look. And so the economics will always be important. I think making sure that it drives smart decisions for everybody at all levels of the business is really important.
Fantastic conversation with Greg Shaheen, the former NCAA administrator. He was the point person for the committee. Greg, thank you very much. Enjoy the weekend and, of course, the next few weeks as we all watch what happens in Indianapolis.
Great to see you, Paul.
Thank you very much. One of the most respected people in the industry An enormous responsibility that he had at the NCAA. We will take a break. More of your phone calls at 855-242-7285. Tennessee and Florida has gone final with the Vols winning by 12. They dominated almost the entire way. Big win for Rick Barnes. Mike White's team will still make it to the NCAA tournament. The question is, where will they be seated after losing today to the Vols? Right now, they're on the 8-9 line, which is a tough place to be because the winner of that game, assuming they win, will play the number one seed in their bracket. So Tennessee moves on and will take on Alabama tomorrow in the first game of the doubleheader. And a reminder, that game is on ESPN. I realize some of you were wondering today. And let's get back to the phone calls here at 855-242-7285 and talk to Will, who is in North Carolina. Hey, Will, thanks. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Paul. Two things here. First, I'm the guy who always calls and asks about Henry Toa Toa, but that's not why I'm calling today. Calling out a concern about my ACC tournament and basketball. My allegiance is usually with Duke, and you've seen how that's worked out the past 2 days. But